So we think about the importance of our work and wanting to make sure that the genes we identify could be useful, perhaps as breeding targets, and potentially be contributing to ways to enhance yield, depending, of course, on what the goal is. So, you know, with corn, quite often we're thinking about seed development and, you know, filling seed. And so being able to enhance the ability to either export from the leaves or import into the cob, into the kernels, is one of the key targets that we want to be able to enhance, to maximize.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, I'm excited to have on Dr. David Braun, Professor of Plant Science and Technology and Biological Sciences Director, Interdisciplinary Plant Group at the University of Missouri-Columbia. Dr. Braun's research is focused on the genetic and molecular control of carbon partitioning in plants, particularly how sugars are transported and allocated from leaves to developing tissues, such as roots, stems, and seeds. Using genetic and genomic approaches in crops like maize and sorghum, his work aims to better understand the mechanisms of underlying plant growth and yield. Dr. Braun is a recognized leader in plant biology, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and has received multiple awards for his contributions to plant genetics and crop science. Dr. Braun, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
So as we jump in, I'd like to do, you know, Share with the audience, how did you end up doing what you do? I'm assuming as 12 years old, you're not thinking, you know what, I'm going to be diving into carbon partitioning.
No, you're absolutely correct. I kind of came at it a little bit out of left field. I grew up in Los Angeles in a very urban area with almost no exposure to agriculture, really, other than the gardens in my grandparents' house and fruits and vegetables they would grow. And I knew from an early age I loved science, but there's no scientist in my family. I'm the only one. So everyone was a lawyer or an accountant or a teacher. And so I was encouraged to go to college. And in college, I thought I was going to be a medical doctor. And so I was taking sort of the introductory biology courses, and I got to the genetics course, and I just loved it. I really appreciated the elegance and the importance and the power. And I was talking to the professor who taught the course and got to know him a little bit and found out he ran a research lab. And I was thinking selfishly in the back of my mind, oh, it's going to be really good if I get into a research lab. That'll be a letter of recommendation that'll help me get into medical school. But I got in, so I volunteered in his lab, and he agreed to take me, and I got into his lab, and it opened up my eyes that you could have a career investigating research. And I was a kid in a candy store. I loved being in the lab, and just the creativity, the freedom, the opportunities to do new and innovative and things that no one had done before. So I changed from a pre-medicine track to a biology track. Now, the lab was a microbiology lab, and they were really focused on proteins and enzymatic functions. And it was a great training environment, but it didn't get me to the genetics that I knew and loved. And so I decided for my PhD, I would consider going into plant biology with an emphasis in genetics. And one of my mentors advised me, and he had a colleague here at the University of Missouri and convinced me that I should come to Missouri. So this kid from LA who had, you know, left California, but never for any studies, decided I was going to move to the Midwest and study plant biology and plant genetics for my graduate work. And so that was where I began the journey, not studying the questions about carbon partitioning. That came later, but that was sort of how I pivoted and moved to Missouri and really got exposed to a new way of living and thinking.
So, and you've been in Columbia since, or was there some?
Oh, I moved around. Yeah, sorry. So after I got my PhD, it was in sort of the early to mid 90s, and the technology wasn't what it is, of course, today. And so a lot of the experiments were all sort of early molecular biology, some biochemistry, but not the genetics. We tried some reverse genetic experiments in the early days, but they didn't really provide the insights. And so for my postdoctoral work, I decided to move to a lab that was known for its expertise in genetics. And so it turns out that lab was back in California in Berkeley. And so I moved to UC Berkeley and worked on leaf development in maize for my postdoctoral studies. And that's where I started really to get a deeper dive into understanding how leaves function, how the cells are all programmed. And that sort of was the foundation that eventually led me to carbon partitioning. But after my postdoctoral studies in Berkeley, I actually moved to Penn State University, where I was an assistant professor up to tenure and associates. And then I had the opportunity to move to Missouri. My wife is also a plant biologist and got recruited to Missouri, and they were fortunate to be able to create two positions. So we both moved here. So kind of didn't expect the round trip, but it worked out fabulous.
Most teams don't have a strategy problem. They have a systems problem. Tasks scattered across tools, goals buried in spreadsheets, and metrics no one actually checks. Zentrix OS fixes that. It's a true business operating system that brings tasks, goals, and performance metrics into one connected workspace. So your team always knows what to do, why it matters, and how they're tracking. No more juggling apps. No more missed accountability. Just a clear, organized way to run your business the way it was meant to be run. If you're ready to stop managing chaos and start managing with clarity, Zentrix OS is built for you. Visit ZentrixOS.com and take control of how your team operates.
So before getting into the science, I have to ask, one of your titles is the director of the interdisciplinary plant group at U of M. Okay, dive into what all that is. I envision a whole lot of chaos, but, you know.
Well, it's chaos in a fun way. So the Interdisciplinary Plant Group, we abbreviated the IPG to make it a little easier to say because it's a mouthful. It's a program in its 45th year. So it was started back in 1981, and it was an era where, you know, there were many smaller departments, biochemistry, biology, agronomy, horticulture, plant pathology. And so you'd have some of the fundamental scientists, but they would be siloed and fragmented in all these different departments. So the IPG was created as an umbrella group to bring the fundamental plant physiologists, geneticists, biochemistry, who are interested in understanding how plants operate together. And so, and it's been successful ever since. We run a weekly seminar series. We have an annual symposium. And it's been a way to bring together a large collaborative environment. We now have like 63 faculty led teams. And so it's the students, the postdocs, the academic staff and technicians. And we all come together around learning and sharing our passion for plant biology.
So as we have had a centralization in a manner of some of our sciences, what groups are now involved in that? So what disciplines what colleges within UNM are involved?
Yeah, so we try to be, you know, inclusive and broad. So the colleges are College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources, the College of Arts and Science, the College of Engineering, but we also have faculty who have joint appointments that include the School of Medicine, and then we also include all of our USDA ARS colleagues who have their labs here on campus. And so we have a lot, the plant genetics unit here. So we have a lot of corn and soybean researchers who are included as well.
which I'll say most of my experience with Columbia is ARS on their soil fertility side. Back when I was a grad student, early career, those ARS professionals in that soil fertility and agronomy group are really some of my mentors and were huge leaders in the industry. But I guess moving on, so let's get into the science. Tell us about what you do as a scientist. You know, what are you working on?
So my lab tries to understand how plants partition their carbohydrate resources. And in maize and sorghum, mostly we're thinking about long distance movement of sucrose. So stepping back, plants are complex organisms. They have different tissues that have really different functions, right? So roots are underground and they are important for anchoring the plant in soil and taking up water and mineral nutrients. Stem and leaves are above ground, really designed for maximizing the photosynthetic canopy, doing carbon dioxide fixation, converting it ultimately into sugar, sucrose, and that sucrose has to move from the leaves long distance to all of the non-photosynthetic tissues, roots, seeds, flowers, etc. That process has been studied for many, many decades, sort of at the physiological or the anatomical level, but it hadn't really been understood at the genetic level. Like, what are the genes in the plants that are really important for enabling that process to work? And so that's kind of the question that my lab is investigating. So we use genetics, both forward genetics, reverse genetics, genomics, and we try to investigate what genes are important for the plant to be successful. So when we identify those genes and we break them deliberately, the plant is in general sick. I kind of think of it similar to humans who have diabetes. They have a dysregulation of moving blood sugar around. In that case, it's glucose. Our plants have a dysregulation of moving sucrose around. So sucrose pools up in the leaves, and they have way, way too much sugars and other, you know, storage forms of starch and carbohydrates in the leaves. And those other non-photosynthetic tissues, the roots, et cetera, are starving. They're not getting their proper allocation. So then we know a gene is important. It affects the process. And we set out to understand, well, does that gene operate alone? No gene operates alone. They operate in genetic pathways. So what other genes are functioning with that pathway through genetic and molecular biology experiments? Obviously, we try to clone and identify the gene to characterize its function at the cell biology or the biochemical level, and get more of a holistic understanding of how much this gene is really important for contributing to overall allocation decisions.
So as you look at you deregulate to find out the importance, do you upregulate to see if you can have added value downstream?
Yep, it's a great question. We do. You know, we're still really trying to identify sort of the tools in the toolbox, but we do deliberately try to overexpress or manipulate the expression to see, is it possible to engineer and enhance the allocation? And to be honest, we haven't had a lot of great success with doing that. Plants are more complex than just stepping on the gas and, you know, jamming the accelerator to the floor and expecting that to lead to doubling in yield. They have many, many different ways to kind of keep that process balanced, because it would be very detrimental if it's, you know, too out of control. But we have been able to kind of slightly increase the dosage, for example, of a really important sugar transporter that we're studying and looking at the impact on, you know, growth and yield.
So as we look at this, and a lot of our listeners, while it's fairly academic, we got a lot of agronomists and crop consultants who also follow this podcast. How do you relate your work to their daily life?
Yeah, it's a good question. So So we think about the importance of our work and wanting to make sure that the genes we identify could be useful, perhaps as breeding targets, and potentially be contributing to ways to enhance yield, depending, of course, on what the goal is. So, you know, with corn, quite often we're thinking about seed development and, you know, filling seed. And so being able to enhance the ability to either export from the leaves or import into the cob, into the kernels, is one of the key targets that we want to be able to enhance, to maximize. with sorghum, that could also be important, but we also think a lot about sweet sorghums and you know, thinking about potential for alternative storage forms of carbon or alternative uses. So it really is crop dependent, but we try very much to keep centered the value of our work and how it can contribute. But, you know, for most of the corn work, essentially, and some of the sorghum, we're not going to be developing new varieties. That's going to be in partnership with the seed companies. And so we have great partnerships with Corteva, with Bayer, with others. And so we, you know, disseminate our work. We collaborate with scientists at those companies. And we hope that the discoveries we make will eventually, you know, fit into their pipeline in ways that enhance yield.
So in your first description, I actually have a note on here, and I was thinking about it because you said sweet sorghum. I'm thinking of forage sorghum, a hay grazer. Would there be long thought potential of increasing that sucrose and glucose in the leaf tissue, but not significantly negatively affecting biomass, or at least affecting quality and such that there's a quality and biomass trade-off?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity. We could think about, you know, improving silage or improving the quality of the leaves and stems, but not at a terrible cost. Now, you know, in some levels, we have to always keep in mind that we have to enhance, you know, photosynthesis to drive more carbon assimilation if we're going to leave more carbon in the stem and the leaves without negatively impacting the terminal sinks, the seed. But I do think that is possible. So, you know, a lot of our thinking is driven sort of as a whole source and sink. You need the physiological strength to be able to provision the carbon and enough of the demand to be able to utilize that carbon without getting out of balance.
So I'm now a lot of curiosity, so I apologize. I'm kind of jumping, but when you were talking about deregulating or shutting off some of the genes and effectively getting the carbohydrates stuck in the leaf and not being able to reallocate to the root, when you're doing that, is that negative influence on the root? Is it pure biomass? Is it growth rate? Is it length? What phenotypic changes are you doing when you shut that down?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's all of the above. You know, you can think of it as a starvation response in the root. So we see, again, with different mutants, different aspects, but sort of overall generalization, the root meristem is not getting enough nutrients in order to divide regularly, in order to expand. So we see a reduction in the number of different roots. We see a reduction in the elaboration of those roots. They don't grow as well. They don't grow as long. They're thinner. You know, the root system is strongly reduced. And so, you know, in the extreme examples, the plants will lodge with just a mild wind because they just have never really developed the architecture and the depth to really support the plant as it grows.
I think it's fascinating and important for a lot of the audience to get is that carbohydrate partitioning as you're moving it back and forth, and that even the slight limitation of getting a carbohydrate to the root, which could negatively influence root structure. Now you're negatively influencing water uptake, nutrient uptake, and it's this downhill cycle where you start the ball rolling and then the whole thing shuts down. So just the importance of understanding that is critical. Can you maybe elaborate on just the importance of the topics?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of carbohydrate partitioning as sort of one of the central, you know, underpinnings of our food and energy supply. You know, no matter what crop you're thinking about, plants evolve this incredible niche to fix carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, convert it into sugars, and then build everything else. Yes, nitrogen and all the mineral nutrients are very important. I've got a carbon-centric view. But, you know, no matter what you're thinking about, our original clothing coming from cotton or linen, you know, we've domesticated plants to make a carbon-derived product that then we could utilize. Of course, wood for fire, for building, for all kinds of tools. Our entire food supply, you know, the harvest index is really maximizing what we can achieve, you know, what we can harvest from the plants without, you know, too much detrimental to the vegetative biomass. And of course, now with biofuels and liquid transportation fuels, all of that is really the application of carbohydrate partitioning.
So in the years, and I'm not saying you've been at it for a long time, but you've been at it for a little while. So over the years, you know, what things have you just kind of shook in your head at or had to take that second look, say, man, I did not expect this to happen?
Oh, yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, there have been many, many surprises along the way. So sort of from the early days when I started into this field, we really only knew about a handful of specific protein sugar transporters that were involved in moving sucrose around. And they had been really well characterized in sort of the classical dicotyledonous plants. So the Arabidopsis, tobacco, tomato, potato, but much, much less had been done in the grasses. And of course, the grasses provide something like 60% of all of our ultimate calories that humans consume, whether directly from plants or from feeding it to animals. But less had been done. There'd been some work in rice, and so, but it had not supported that these proteins were very important. So when we set out to study it in maize, we were the first to show that yes, these really are important. And maybe the surprise was that rice and maize, which are closely related grasses, may end up doing things differently. And we found that over and over again. So it's sort of this really interesting surprise, maybe caused by domestication or evolution, that different crops have kind of come to different solutions of how to control carbohydrate partitioning. And the same transporters may not be that equally important. I'm not saying they're not important at all, but they don't have the predominant role that we see. And so we kind of approach the problem of defining genes important from carbohydrate partitioning with that sucrose transporter background. And we set out and did large genetic screens and found many, many more of these mutants that are defective in carbohydrate partitioning. Another surprise has been that other than one, none of the genes have turned out to be sucrose transporters. We've identified a whole host of additional genes that I didn't initially expect. So we've learned a lot as we've kind of delved deeper and deeper into this about all these different ways that different functions, different genes can impact that process.
So I know that overall, we're still kind of just scratching the surface of the science. Has there been any look at the functions of pre-hybridization and post-hybridization?
There's been some, not enough. I mean, people have looked at sort of earlier ancestors. I'm thinking of corn, about teosinte. In sorghum, there are earlier races. I haven't looked at those as much. I think that's an interesting question. Similarly, in rice, people have looked at wild ancestors of rice and done the comparison. But I think there's probably a lot more we can learn in terms of, you know, looking at genomic selection, looking at what regions of the genome have been selected during domestication and their contributions to carbohydrate partitioning.
Just random question, is the knowledge base, because the rice knowledge base is pretty good, is it because of where the science was somewhat developed? We were heavily UC and other universities. When I think of the universities involved in this, are a fair amount are somewhat rice centric.
Yeah, a lot of the rice work came out of Asia, where obviously it's predominant crop. So early work in Japan and in China focused heavily on the earliest papers I'm thinking about in rice. And then, yeah, corn was mostly North America, and sorghum is a little bit later to the game. There were some papers that were people were characterizing the functions of carbohydrate partitioning in sorghum back in the 70s and 80s, but they were a smaller in teams and fewer investments.
Sorghum's always that left behind that we just play with. It's good for our producers.
It's becoming dominant now, but yeah, early on, certainly.
Is there much work in soybean, or is this been so far corn-centric?
No, there's work in soybean. It's also was a little bit slower, I think, just because of the polyploid genome and the challenges with transformation. But there definitely have been people who've been focused on this question in soybean as well. And again, I think there are some surprises there that it hasn't been quite as clear. People have tried expressing these sucrose transporters in soybean to drive higher rates of pod development, but that hasn't really, so far that I've seen, paid out. So I think that the foundational knowledge is the same, but how it'll get applied is going to be a little bit different.
Theoretically, is there any influence of some of these genes with nodulation on how that plant is interacting with the rhizobium?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't seen, I mean, they're certainly very important in terms of the carbon exchange to actually support the bacteria, but it's a different form of organic carbon that gets exchanged. So it's a different family of transporters. But ultimately, absolutely, if the plant is not able to provision the fixed carbon to the microbe, it's not going to leave to a productive nodule, and then bacteria will never develop enough to fix nitrogen and be able to deliver the ammonia to the plants.
So I guess one last question I would have is what, you know, if you look at your lab today or this week, what are you guys doing today right now? What's your active topic?
Yep. So I have different people in the lab. Some of them are working on the carbohydrate partitioning defective, these CPD mutants that we've identified. And so we're working to, you know, characterize, as I mentioned, a couple of them and put them in a genetic pathway and test, do they function similarly or do they have unique roles? And that's a lot of microscopy and biochemistry and genotyping. And then I have another lab member who's more focused on the sorghum project. We have a new recent grant from the Department of Energy. And so we're gearing up to do a lot of carbon-14, a radioactive isotope of carbon that we can trace its movement. And we want to look at the ability of different leaves in sorghum plants grown in the field at different heights in the canopy to be able to export sugar and to understand what might be the trade-offs or bottlenecks in that. So anyway, the postdoc is helping me. We're gearing up doing some practice and control experiments before the field season to get ready for that.
It's time for our famous three.
Every person on your team is wired differently. Some thrive with structure. Others drive results through autonomy. Some process information fast and move on. Others need depth before they decide. And when the wrong person is in the wrong seat, not because of skill, but because of how someone is built, performance suffers and no one knows why. Zentrix Insights maps exactly that. Behavioral patterns, cognitive style, and natural work preferences are all visible in 15 minutes. So you stop guessing who should own what and start putting the right people in the right seats. Because the best teams are not just talented, they are well-placed. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Well, we're going to move and transition into our final three questions, which this first one's intriguing to me is it really seems like you're on that forefront. So being on the forefront of the science, you know, what is your go-to work resource? Where do you go when you have questions, since it seems like you're on the edge of it?
Well, it kind of depends, of course, on the question. I mean, literature is always fantastic. So one of the first things I'll do if I'm beginning to think about a new question is try to, you know, use Google Scholar or Web of Science to find scientific papers if somebody has published on something similar before. Of course, with AI coming in now, I'm using some of the AI tools to, you know, delve a little deeper or kind of have a little bit of back and forward. I find some of them easier to get reiterative questions to help me hone what perhaps initially was a broad question, but I wanted to get a little bit more specific and still, you know, try to find the relevant literature. Talking to colleagues at scientific conferences is also really, really valuable. As I mentioned, this basic question has been studied for a long time. And so I always enjoy going to conferences and talking to some of the, you know, senior members of the community, because they have such depth of knowledge of what's, you know, gone on before. And they know a lot of the players from the 50s, 60s, 70s that are a little hard to find, some of those classic papers, so, or things that didn't get published, but they have those really insightful observations that can steer you toward a new direction.
I mean, it always amazes me in the sciences what those that were doing the work in the 50s through the 70s did without the technology we have today is just mind-boggling to me.
Absolutely. And you know, probably not enough of those papers are read any longer today. There's some classic experiments and really profound insights, as you say, done with pretty simple approaches, but so well-designed experiments, so clean results. It really is mind-boggling how much they were able to learn.
As we move on to something a little bit more fun, I mean, you're in a beautiful city. I've always loved Columbia. So what do you do in your free time? Because it seems like you've got a lot of free time based upon what we've talked about.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, I do have a few passions outside of work that I enjoy. I wish I had more free time, but we're getting there. So one of the things I love to do is gardening. Mm. And since you been here in Colombia, maybe you remember, you know, the soils here are pretty heavy clay. So gardening is a little bit of a chore. And so we have some, you know, raised beds, and every year I'm amending them and trying to add or more organic material and compost. And I think it was during the pandemic, I had one of those epiphanies. You know, I think I was probably watching a YouTube video, and I came across straw bale gardening, and I had not heard of it before. And that has changed my approach. So right now I'm not fertilizing my straw bales, turning them into compost every morning and getting ready. And so gardening now is no longer quite the burden. It's much more the excitement and the fun and really being able to grow so many more different things that we're struggling with previously. So gardening is certainly one. I'm a big proponent of community preparedness. So I'm a member of our Boone County Community Emergency Response Team. And so I train monthly with the team. I do, you know, training and exercises independent of that. But I'm, you know, someone who advocates for making sure that people can first take care of their family, then their neighborhood, then their community. And so I try to be prepared and assist and be ready if ever called upon to help. So doing things along with that. And then, yeah, here in Colombia, we have a fantastic trail system. I love walking, hiking, biking on the trails. The weather's getting beautiful. So as I can, I'll get out today. I rode my bike into work, so it's fantastic. I get that gorgeous scenery and relaxation on the way in and at home on the way out. So I'll look forward to that.
That's amazing. As a final wrap up, David, where do people go to find out more about your work and your research?
So probably the easiest way is just to Google my name, David Braun, University of Missouri. That'll take you right to my lab's webpage. Or if you wanted to know more about the interdisciplinary plant group, IPG, you could add that. I've got a page there as well. And both of them will link to my Google Scholar page where you could get information about our publications and my email address. If you have any questions and want to follow up, please send me an email. Reach out. I'd be happy to do what I can to answer them.
Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wyzenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. David Braun, professor of plant science and technology and biological sciences at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Remember, if you've enjoyed this podcast, hit that subscribe button so you get notifications every time we drop a new one. And also make sure you share this video with friends and colleagues just to get the word out about the Crop Science Podcast. And as always, leave us a comment with questions or suggestions for new guests that we need to have on. David, thank you so much for joining. I've really enjoyed our discussion today.
Brian, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.